Namaste. So today we take up the subject of Sanatan Dharma and the legal system or the justice system, whatever way we want to put it. So we are living in, of course, very interesting times, so without a doubt about it. Why it's interesting is because it's throwing up new, unique challenges. So there are periods when life goes static. People accept fixed positions and they have to live according to that. And this fixed position is strengthened by law. It is how things are meant to be, and they are that way. So during that time, we see mystics withdraw into the cave, solitude, turn toward the divine, declaring that this world is what it is. They also accept the world and all its ugliness or unfairness or whatever little good there is. And it's like a fixed situation. Then there comes a time for change. So all evolution is like that. So during the time of change, we see that all the fixed things are challenged and made upset. They are upset. There is an upsetting of the old order. And in this upsetting, lot of comfort zones are shaken and a new thing has to emerge. So this new is not just, of course, it's not, obviously it's not about fashion, because fashionable changes are like nothing changes inside, you change the dress, but you are the same human being inside. So fashion is like cosmetic changes outside. But right now we are facing many unique challenges, and in every field. So one of them is, for instance, the field of justice system. So like everything else, one thing which Sanatan Dharma brings forward to us, and in this sense it is quite modern, though it is Sanatan, it accepts the evolutionary process of life. So Sanatan Dharma doesn't take a fixed, hard, rigid stand of do's and don'ts. That is how we see certain Semitic religious laws, they take a stand. Thou shalt do this, thou shalt not do this. That is how we read in moral science. Black and white. But Sanatan Dharma accepts that human beings move through zones of gray. Life is never a clear-cut black and white. And other than this hard kind of dogmatic religious doctrines, we also had a more rational democratic system where human thought tried to understand what should be an ideal. So that is what we follow in many of the places where the legal system follows a kind of evolution of human thought. So people take up a discussion like capital punishment, for example. They discuss about it, child marriages, many aspects they take up. And then they decide based on how reason argues this side or that side. Here, reason is the advocate. So in Sanatan Dharma, reason has its place, but reason is the advocate. But this advocate can tilt the argument in any side's favor. So, for example, now there is a very challenging, very controversial thing which was known in India as, in not only India, it was everywhere incidentally, child marriage. Now I'm taking up this aspect just to touch upon it. Now, is child marriage good or bad? Now, there was a very interesting movie, I don't know whether people have seen it or not, Balika Badhu. Now, it touches upon a side of child marriage which is never conceptualized by modern thought. So, in this, the marriage takes place early, but there is no physical consummation. So, they take care of this fact that the woman is not ready, the man is not ready to have a child. So, they stay away. But what is happening in the process, as the movie very interestingly shows, that they start drawing closer emotionally. So it is something very fascinating. So many of the problems that we face today, in adolescent you fall in love, but you don't get married and you have had certain experiences. It's okay. It's not about judging those experiences. You go through experiments, and at the end of it, you break free. Then you go through another kind of experiences. There's a lot of trauma, experimentation involved. But in child marriage, I'm not advocating child marriage, but I'm just saying it was a perspective wherein people got married And then they developed emotional attachment, even a certain kind of longing for each other was nurtured and nourished. And then when they came together, when they were ripe, this was called a second marriage, the term used was different. They had understood each other well and gelled into each other. They like grown home to each other. So this was one dimension which a more subtler psychological understanding of human nature had brought out. So law also operates at many levels. This is the other aspect we have to understand. Today we see the technicalities of law, whether you have technically done this or not, technically your papers are correct or not. So when law becomes technical, it does the same mistake what we see in religion as a very dogmatic do's and don'ts. You did this, therefore you must be punished. You did not, or you put your feet facing Makkah, therefore you should be punished. Now, you know, this is where a technical aspect comes into play. And we know that that famous story of Guru Nanak, where this thought is challenged. How it is challenged? He says, okay, you show me where Mecca is not. So, at many levels, human consciousness operates, and the defect of the rational democratic system is, it doesn't take that into account. For example, if we take a challenge that should the law be much more strict with those who are in positions of power than those who are a commoner? I think the instinctive, intuitive sense should be yes. Isn't it? It should not be just equal. But today you see in practice what happens. Those who are in position of power, when justice comes to them, there is a tendency to say, even so-called guardians of freedom, I mean, this terrorist who was killed recently in India. So the headlines in BBC and The Guardian were, you know, former MP, ex-MP. So these were the headlines. On the contrary, it should be that if somebody was a member of parliament or is a member of parliament, the law should be far more strict. So if we look at the ancient times, the way they had discovered the system of law, it was far more stringent and to be strictly applied to a man sitting on top. And that's what we see in the story of Ram. I'll take just one example from Sanatan Dharma, which is again very much misinterpreted story, is the story of Ahilya. I think everybody has heard the story of Ahilya, but most of us have heard it wrong. So we have heard that this lady had, poor lady, she was cursed by her angry husband. And she had to suffer till Ram came. This is not how the story is there in the actual Valmiki Ramayana. So how the story goes, part of it is correct, that Ahilya and Gautam Rishi are married. Ahilya is no ordinary woman. She is a Tapaswini. Both are pursuing a path of yoga. So when a yogi is practicing an ascension of consciousness, things are very different from what is applying in ordinary common life. But then what happens, as they are progressing, Indra, usual problem, the Indra of the Puranas, he is troubled. This is how it is portrayed. Actually, it is not that Indra is troubled. Indra wants to see whether you are ready or not to take that next leap. So Ahilya is no ordinary woman. So he himself comes to, in the story it is that he comes to, you know, he is attracted towards her. And the two get together. He changes the form of her husband while the husband is away, and they have a physical relation. And when the husband is returning, he sees Indra go out, and that is the time he gives a curse to Indra and he gives a curse to his wife. Now you see, look at this story sounds gross injustice for a small little act. Now that there are missing elements of the story which are there in Valmiki Ramayana. So the story goes that she understood, because she is a yogini. She is not one who is just carried away by the form. She is a yogini. She understands the difference of consciousness. She knows in the actual story that he is Indra. And for a moment, she is moved by this idea that master of the Lord of the gods, the God of gods, is drawn towards me. So you see, there is the first difference that comes. And even when she has understood, she is moved by this idea that I am not just, you know, my tapasya has taken me to what level, my yoga has taken me to what level, that even the God of the gods desires me. So this is the inner fact of the story. And when the rishi sees what is the curse, it's very interesting. In all these curses, which were like a punishment, you will see a boon which is hidden. So he curses to Ahilya that you have done something which you shouldn't have done, because they were both progressing onto a very beautifully towards a high mountain road. And he curses us that, you know, now as a redemption, you have to do a far greater tapasya than you have done so far. And to Indra also he gives a very interesting curse. So Indra he curses that may you lose all your capacity. He in fact curses him with impotence. Now you see, it's very interesting. Transform this, transpose it onto a human level. Imagine Indra is not just Indra as a god. Indra is a state of consciousness which human beings can arrive at. Now a human being who through evolution has reached this point of development, and then he commits such an act. So to tell him that your sexual capacity goes away, is it a curse or is it a boon? That is an interesting question. And to Ahilya, what she does, the story describes that she stops eating, drinking, and becomes one-pointed and focused upon the eternal. Now the proof is when Ram is coming to through the forest, you know, after slaying Taraka. So when he slays Taraka and comes through the forest, Vishwamitra describes that there is a great tapaswini who dwells in this forest. He doesn't describe that she is a cursed woman. That is a left liberal thought. See, this little twist changes everything. See, there is a tapaswini whose tej is very profound, and he wants to touch her feet. This is the story, and not the other way around. And that's when she is fulfilled and she goes back. She is like a goddess. That is how it is described. And she changes into a goddess mold. Now, when we look at the story in this way, how subtle dilemmas in Sanatana Dharma, it's so many subtle dilemmas are brought out. And that's why it's so important to understand law is not just a question of technicality. In the same story, when Rama is to kill Taraka, so you know what is his dilemma? His dilemma is she's a woman. I can't kill her. And Vishwamitra has to tell him, she may be a woman, but she is doing something which is gross adharma. And that is the time, even then, he is mollycoddling her. Till finally she starts hitting very hard. And that's when Ram chooses to, you know, shoot a deadly arrow. Now this is one kind of dilemma. There are several such dilemmas. So if you really look at these scriptures, they will bring out, they are so modern, I find. One such story is the story of Draupadi. Now Draupadi has 5 husbands. Imagine in today's scenario. Ultra modern or regressive and ancient? I don't know what the law will have to say. I don't think law allows it. But how does it take place in the time of Draupadi? See, there it's very, very, very fascinating story how it takes into account the psychological dimension of law. So when Draupadi is married, there is a dilemma. I'm leaving aside that the mother said share with everybody, that they could have said mama is not a bounty, it's a woman. It was as simple as that. They were not such foolishly obedient children. But look at how the whole marriage takes place. Now, according to the law, according to the traditional understanding of that time, Arjun should marry her. Why? Because Arjun is the one who has won the competition. But according to the other tradition, equally existing, Yudhishthira should marry, being the eldest brother. Now, Yudhishthira sees something very fascinating, and that's how he justifies the marriage of all 5 brothers to one woman. So he says that when he is asked this in the Kuru Sabha, he says that, you know, I saw my brothers, and Draupadi is so extremely beautiful that all these brothers were looking at her with eyes. So you see this kind of thing, that instead of a hypocritical solution, he brings a very realistic solution. So why not we all marry and she will keep all of us together? So Draupadi becomes like the soul of all these five people. It's a very interesting thing that, you know, he mentions in this sabha. Very challenging. I mean, today's generation doesn't want to be hypocrites. And if you really look at that time, what Yudhishthir says, he was speaking a truth of human psychology, that she's going to live together with all of us. And I don't want that the brothers start developing a kind of jealousy or envy. So each of them married, but Draupadi was the common wife. But even more interesting is when Draupadi is asked, how do you justify? So Draupadi says in three short words, which is the essence of law in Sanatana Dharma. She says, very famous one, but very few people may remember the context. Dharmo rakshati dharma. She says, what is dharma? She says, that which defends the dharma. If I did not marry, I married one, it would not defend the dharma. It will lead to adharma of various kinds. So I have done it to defend the dharma. What a subtle way. Whereas Bhishma goes into technicalities when, you know, in the Kuru Sabha. So there are levels at which law operates. One is the most outer technical level, and if we make that the foremost, then there is no chance of evolution in law. Another is at psychological level, which takes into consideration the hierarchical arrangement through which human beings move. You can't have the same law applying. I have spoken about this in the previous talk also. To a seeker after wisdom and to somebody who is yet, you know, beginning his life's journey. You can't have the same law applying. This, of course, has come in. But it is more in terms of juvenile and adult. But we have to take into consideration the stage of evolution, the education, the responsible position at which a person stands. And the law ideally should be far more strict, because your actions are the one which are going to have repercussions. And the third thing where law operates, not only physical and psychological, but spiritual level. So law has a spiritual dimension. The mother speaks about it, that India is the land where the psychic law has ruled, and the time has come once more for the psychic law to govern. So what is the psychic law? Psychic law doesn't act according to the typical human norms and standards. I just gave one example. And there are many such examples when we read through. I don't want to get into a host of these stories like Shambhuk, but many of these which are, you know, people raise questions, and they are so fascinating, where they reveal this psychic element when you take a decision. In other words, when we look at the law as it evolves in nature, so the first law of nature is might is right. In natural justice, it's a truth. We may completely sideline it, but it's the first law that acts. And Shubhendu says that when we look at the world with this eyes, when we talk about rebirth and karma, we say, why is it that a cunning man succeeded? Well, a cunning man, even in nature, the cunning fox succeeds if it knows how to have a pack. It is its ability given by nature, and attacks a lonely lion. And that is where we see Shri Krishna says, in the cunning of the cunning, it is he who operates. So there is a truth behind even that. If you have a strong gunda, you know, have a fist fight with an honest man who has never been trained into martial art, the honest man will lose. This is, you can't blame God for it. Honest man has something else with which he must equip if he has to face the challenge. So there is another level of the operation of the law. First is at the most material level, nature's law is, if you make a match to match, whoever is stronger, that person wins. But there is another level, and that is at the inner level that this law operates. So that we see in Sri Aurobindo's story, Swapna, that while a person with dishonest means, cunning means, will have all the money, but he will lack the joy and peace which comes through honesty. So we often don't understand God's play because we say, oh, I was so honest, yet I failed. You may fail outwardly, but still there is another level. When you are honest in your dealings, you will grow in moral strength. That is the reward of honesty. The reward of honesty is not that you will make a lot of money. You may or may not. There can be an honest business. That's how mother started the honesty store here. That she wanted to change this law. So she has tried many things which can change the... So she tried in the field of business, which is a very difficult field. And Shobindu entered into a much more darker field, politics. So the law should change. So in politics, he brought love for the motherland, worship of the country as mother. This is the most darkest field. And the reason he withdrew was that he said that the world is not ready, India is not ready to follow that deeper truth. Politics is not ready. But one day it will be ready. In business, the mother did start a new model of business, which is honest business. So this is the other level, the spiritual level, at which when we do something which is good, which is honest, which is truthful, then our heart is at peace. Unless we start eyeing the other fruit. So the reward of goodness is ascension of consciousness, stability of consciousness, peace of consciousness. Its reward is not necessarily material wealth or material success. It may or may not come. That's a different aspect altogether. That's how the law of karma operates, as given in the Gita. Then there is a third dimension of this law, which takes into account the deepest spiritual aspiration of a human being, which we don't consider. It is there in nature, it operates. That's how God's Vidhika Vidhan works. And its classic example, if I may use the word, is when Shobindu is taken to jail. So when Shobindu is taken to jail, Shobindu says that he never wanted anything for himself. Look at his own life. He never wanted anything for himself. His acts were never sprang from a selfish wish for anything. And he says, all that I wanted was that the country should progress. It should become freed, independent. So he asks the divine, he raises a prayer, that why am I here? I had asked for your protection till the country becomes free. But then, we know the rest is history. He appears and says that I have brought you here because you have a greater purpose. So in other words, law has a third dimension. The dimension is reform and transform rather than punish. Punishment doesn't put things in order, but it must change us. It should help us to change, which means prison should become reformatory. That change is beginning to come. It should not be just handcuffed and put behind the bars, but also turn that place into what we see in Shobindu's own life. He changed it by his own yoga tapas power into a ashram. Now, of course, that jail is completely shifted, and it's nice that that place has actually become a place where people can visit. It's no more a jail. So I believe that that whole jail is shifted elsewhere, within Kolkata. I haven't been and seen, but people tell me. So it's something very interesting that the whole purpose of law, is it only to punish and thereby create an order, or is it to reform and transform things? And should it take into account deeper dimension? So now I'll come to two burning topics. One is euthanasia. So euthanasia, mercy killing is being debated. So mercy killing is based on the idea that somebody is unconscious, cannot become well, and we are presuming that the person is suffering. Therefore, his or her life should be taken away. Now we really do not know whether that person is suffering or the relatives are suffering. This dilemma is largely a modern dilemma, because in India, you'll see in the Indian medical system, we had Sanjeevani Bhuti and life-giving medicine, but ventilators and this support system, artificial life support system, did not develop. And one reason is because we believe in rebirth. So we don't believe that one life is the end of things. But when you look at the Western world, it believes that one life is the end of things. So this insistence on prolonging life somehow is there. So you have generated an artificial dilemma. It's like you create an artificial need in the market. And then you try to find a way to balance it. So in any case, when Mother was asked about it, she said that, how do you know that the inner consciousness is not continuing to experience something? How do we know that the stone-like Ahalya, outwardly people may have felt that, you know, she is in a state of stone, Jadvat, was not continuing with an inner journey of ascension? And till we know that, till we know the soul's choice, it's best not to disturb that arrangement. But now, if you put a person on ventilator, this problem is bound to come. Now, we don't know whether he is suffering or he is progressing. So these are things which we should become more conscious. And when I see when, at least I'm speaking of the Hindus, they say, ha ha, dal do ventilator par. You know, an old person who has multiple organ failures, who is not going to lead a... So don't try that, because if you do that, you'll be in a dilemma. So this is these are things which are very unique things which are going to come up. And the second is the latest, which I wanted to touch, and that is all these gender issues and gender marriages. The latest one. All these ABCD, LGBT, Q and Q plus and 49 now. You know, they gone to extend that they say there is no gender. You can't say he or she. You have to address as they. No, I hope many of us know that. You can't say he or she because you are having gender bias. You have to say they. So now you see, this is catching a profound truth from the other end and twisting it from the tail and changing it. There is no doubt that nature has made you what you are, and everybody should have a place. There is no doubt about it. And in Sanatana Dharma, the famous story of Shikhandi is there, but the story is very interesting. He is a woman in the previous life. Gender also has a spiritual truth. So Sri Aurobindo says, once you choose a line of gender, generally you follow that line. But accidents can happen, which we see in the life of Shikhandi. So Shikhandi is a woman in the previous life, Amba, who gives her life because she wants to take revenge against Bhishma. So she is born in next life. She is born again as a woman. Originally, Shikhandi is born as a woman. But she is dressed like a man from childhood. And her mother dresses her like a him. So when he grows up, they want to marry her. So when they send the word to the kings all around, all the kings come to know. Rumors are there that it's not a he. So they ultimately, last minute, the marriage is refused. And he has to face a lot of, obviously, it's a very traumatic thing. So she who is a he now goes to a forest where there is a yaksha. And yaksha is moved by, now yakshas are beings of the midworlds. They are neither good nor bad. They are neither this nor that. So when he goes and meets the yaksha, so she tells her story. Yaksha says, okay, it doesn't matter. I'll exchange my gender with you. So he changes her into a him. He says, till you, it will be for a limited period. Then of course the sideline of the story is Kuber comes and curses him. He says, no, till Shikhandi is alive, now you have to remain a woman. Because he has become a woman now. And because you have to maintain the balance of the creation. So Shikhandi becomes a man. Literally it's a transgender or whatever gender change surgery takes place at some level. And then he kills Bhishma, and then we know that he is, you know, killed by Ashwatthama after the war. Then the rest of the story follows. So one thing is very clear, that regardless of your gender, you have a place in society, and the place should be of respect and honor. There should be no doubt about it. But the issue is not even about two people staying together. It's perfectly fine. Whether you are man, woman, as friend, whatever, you can stay together. But when the question is of marriage, then there is a red line we begin to cross. And what is that red line? You can be together. You can sign up property rights. Nobody prevents you from, saying that we have jointly owned this property. But the problem is that marriage is not just a sexual act in Indian thought. Marriage is a sacred act because it's a recreation of a deep, profound truth of Shiva and Shakti, Purusha and Prakriti. So all marriages are supposed to be a reflection of that. And while one may have a feminine nature, it's understandable. Anomalously, it is possible. And another person may have a masculine nature. It's quite likely. But the coming together as a marriage will always remain something incomplete. So the moment you talk about marriage and legal rights, so we raise that question again. Is marriage a legal document or is marriage a divine document? That's where we have to think about. If marriage is a legal document, then it can be done and annulled by the process of law. But if marriage is a sacred act, but not sacred act like the Roman Catholic that once married, forever married, not that sense. But it should be seen as such. The whole society should be sensitized to understand marriage in this way. It's not just an act which is either sexual or a legal act, but something very much more profound. It's meant to bring that. And the second complication that is likely to arise in this situation is, what about the child? Now, people say that, of course, children are adopted by a single parent. It's so true. That's one part, that where situation necessitates that you adopt a child and bring up as a single parent. But it's quite another where you deliberately bring together and have a child who may very much get confused about during the growing up periods. So that's where law probably crosses a line unwittingly. Technically it sounds okay, what's the big deal? Two people want to marry, they can marry. Now we must understand the difference here between they can live together, no problem. But marriage is something else than what law makes it to be. And having a child is not just an act of picking up a child and bringing up the child, but something which involves. Human beings are the only people who are given double parenting. And there is a reason for it. And the reason is not just extra security by nature. The reason is every child, for the harmonious development, needs both these masculine and human children I'm talking of. Masculine and feminine elements for a wholesome development. Both are required for the completeness of the growth. Life is not ideal, understood. But what is ideal is where both come together and contribute their bit to the harmonious development of a child. If not possible, not possible. It's a different thing altogether. We are not talking of that. So marriage and child bringing is something which is not just a legal institutional act, but something which involves the shaping of our individual for the future life. So these are just some of the thoughts. There are no perfect answers as of today because human consciousness is far from reaching that point where it can see the deeper dimensions. It's very far. But law should evolve and move towards that. It should evolve to a point where it is more and more in tune with the deeper divine wisdom that operates in creation. And the divine wisdom, to close it, even when it seems to punish, actually helps. That's how Sri Aurobindo says, even our punishments are a grace. That's how divine, and that's why we see that, and that's a different subject, some other time we can take it. Every curse given by a rishi turned out to be a boon in disguise. So that's how the law should operate eventually, where it should take into consideration all these factors which are operating at any given point of time. Appeal not just to the technical details of the law, not even to the reason and senses, You saw this happen and the reason decides. But to the higher buddhi, which receives intuitively some guidance from above and appeal to the deepest innate psychic sense and then arrive at a decision. Namaste.